So we're we looked at, you know, it's going too fast on me here. Oh, that's no one's for. All right, let's try this again. So Revelation 2, 8 through 11 is the message to Smyrna. We looked through part of this last week. Thank you, David. For each of these seven, there is a title that Christ uses to describe himself. Generally, it is two things. We're going to see with Pergamon, it's just going to be one. But he says that he is the first and the last. And we saw last week that if you know the book of Isaiah, at least three times in Isaiah, God the Father is referred to as the first and the last. So what the book is doing here, what Jesus is doing, is saying that I am God. There may be another thing here. These cities like to brag about their position. And Smyrna liked to talk about that they were the first city in the province of Asia. And it said that some other cities made that claim too. But so there is a slight chance that, you know, you're in a city that claims to be the first. And Jesus to the Christian says, you know, I am the first. And I'm not just the first, I'm the last as well. So there may be some kind of comparison there between Jesus and, you know, the city and city pride. He also says he's the one who died and came to life again. Well, that obviously refers to his resurrection. But again, there may be a hint of something else in there. Smyrna was destroyed in the year 600 BC by the Lydians. And it lay dormant for about 300 years. Alexander the Great comes swooping through, and he restores the city. So the city had literally died and come to life again. And again, you know, you can't know for certain, but that may have kind of rung a bell in some people's minds that, well, just as the city came back to life again, and, you know, we're proud to be here, the one we serve, he is the one who died and came to life again. And, of course, that's going to be emphasized, Jesus' sacrifice on our behalf, on behalf of these people that he's writing to, and, of course, on our behalf today, that's going to be emphasized other places in the book of Revelation. So this ought to comfort the Christians, and this ought to reinforce to them and to us today. It ought to be comfort for us. It also ought to be reinforced to us the fact that Jesus is the one who controls history. We can worry a lot about what's going on in this country or around the world, but the point of the book of Revelation is God is in control. And often what's going on are in the unseen realms, but when you look and see what's going on in the unseen realms, God has already won the battle. Satan has been kicked out of heaven. We'll see that later, much later in the book of Revelation. And God is controlling not only history, but it's saying that Jesus even controls the forces of death and life. And these Christians at Smyrna need that kind of assurance and comfort because of what's going to come upon them. And because of what's already come upon them. You know, he says, I know your affliction, your poverty, yet you're rich. Well, we talked last week, probably the affliction and the poverty came upon them because living the Christian life in the city meant that they didn't participate in everything that was going on. And when you don't participate in some of these festivals, these religious festivals and these banquets and everything else, your neighbors get suspicious of you. Your business dealings aren't as good. Maybe you're shunned. Just leads to a lot of problems. Plus, you've got this synagogue of Satan, these people who say they are Jews but are not. Now, that's the second time. We didn't emphasize this last week, but that's the second time, and both of them are here in this letter, that people think they are one thing and they are something else. We're going to find that a total of four times in these seven letters. These people were poor and afflicted. But, and maybe they realized, maybe they didn't, but Jesus says, you're rich. You're just the opposite your actual state is just the opposite of what your physical condition is. And for these Jews, the people that were members of the synagogue, they think they're a synagogue of Yahweh, of God, but they're actually, Jesus says, they're a synagogue of Satan. And that would have been the furthest thing from their mind. And they are slandering the Christians. And we talked about, it happened about 60 years later, but the martyrdom of Polycarp there in the city. The Jews participated in this. In fact, they're the ones that denounced him publicly. And they're the ones that got him martyred. And this was what they said. This teacher of Asia, the father of the Christians, the overthrower of our gods, he who has been teaching many not to sacrifice or to worship the gods. He's martyred in the theater that's up on that hill. Not much in the remains of the theater today. And the Jews were so incensed that they broke the Sabbath to go out and gather firewood to burn him. And again, I don't know what you compare that to. Keeping the Sabbath was so important to them. To break the Sabbath would be like going against the most sacred thing to you, the thing that you hold dearest. You go ahead and do just the opposite. You go ahead and break that, whatever it is that you hold so dear and you religiously adhere to and keep. And you're willing to break it because you are so mad. And they did that in order to have him martyred. The other thing that is of interest is this letter that Pliny the Younger wrote. He was the governor of Pontus and Bithynia. And notice he's the governor from 111 to 113. We're not making this a history class, but you have to understand some of this history and really to understand Revelation. So this is only about maybe like 15, 20 years after the book of Revelation was probably written. And what he does, he's the governor. You were governor for only a couple of years. Then somebody else came in. He writes a letter back to the emperor. And he wants to know, how should I be handling these Christians who are being brought up on charges? Now notice here. It is not the government who is persecuting the Christians. There was no systematic persecution of Christians in the first century. Now, Nero did kick the Jews out of Rome, but that was a localized thing, and some of the Christians get kicked out as well. But the government was not coming down on Christians. They weren't going house to house, sending Christians off to prison and to execution. Rather, what it was from the bottom up. If you didn't like your neighbor, if I saw that Dwayne over there is not participating in the pagan religious festivals that I am, and I think he's not supporting the city, and he's not supporting the emperor, I might go and report him and say, this guy is an atheist. This guy does not believe in the gods. He does not really... He's not loyal to the emperor. He's not loyal to the Roman Empire. And so this is what would happen. Meanwhile, in the case of those who were denounced to me as Christians, I observed the following procedure. And he's writing to the emperor to find out whether he's doing the right thing. I interrogated these as to whether they were Christians. Those who confessed, I interrogated a second time and a third time, threatening them with punishment. Those who persisted, I ordered executed. Those who denied they were or had been Christians when they invoked the gods in words dictated by me, I had them offer prayers with incense and wine to your image. This is to the emperor, to your image, which I had ordered to be brought for this purpose together with statues of the gods, and moreover, curse Christ, none of which those who are really Christians, it is said, can be forced to do. These, I thought, I let them off the hook. So that was his policy. And the emperor writes back and says, you know, you're doing the right thing. We're not out there to systematically, he doesn't use those words, but basically we're not out there just to go after Christians. But if they're brought before you and this is the case and they won't go ahead and acknowledge the emperor and make a little sacrifice here or there. Yeah, go ahead and execute them. That's all right. So you see, again, it was neighbor against neighbor. It was not the state going house to house and saying, are there Christians in this house? Are there Christians in that house? And remember, this is only 15, 20 years after the book of Revelation is written. So I think it shows you what's going on here. He was governor of Pontus and Bithynia, which is right here along the Black Sea. And Sardis is right, Smyrna rather, Smyrna is right here. So it's in the same general neighborhood. And that was pretty much how Christians were being dealt with. And the point is, that's what's going on here at Smyrna as well. So there is no complaint. There are two of the letters, two of the seven, for which Jesus has no complaint against him. That is Smyrna and Philadelphia. He highlights how positive he is about their perseverance in the face of persecution. Don't be afraid of what you are about to suffer. The devil's going to put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. So Jesus ascribes what they're going to be going through as the work of the devil. And he tells them, don't be afraid. Well, they had every reason to be afraid, because when he says some of you are going to be put into prison, what he's really saying, some of you are going to be executed. The Romans weren't known for keeping people in prison. They did not pad their jails and keep people in prison for years. Prison was a holding cell until your punishment was meted out. They didn't waste the time and the money keeping people in prison. You exiled them, or you pretty much executed them. And so when he says some of you are going to be thrown into prison, what they know in the back of their mind is some of us are going to be executed. And so he says, you know, be faithful even to the point of death. And so they have reason not to be afraid, because they are serving the one who rules history. They're serving the one who has power even over death and has overcome death. And he says here, this tribulation is only going to last for a limited amount of time. It's going to last for 10 days. Well, you can take the 10 days a couple of different ways. One way you can take it is 10 24-hour days. And there have been interpreters of Revelation in the past who have taken this as it's going to be a 10-day persecution. But how else can you use when you say 10 days? What else can you mean by it? Could be years, or how long is 10 days? It ain't that long, is it? So it could be that it's just talking about a short period of time. 10 days is used in the book of Revelation a lot as symbolic. So probably when he says this is going to go on for 10 days, it's not a literal 10 days, but it's symbolically there's going to be a short period of time. Also, does 10 days ring any bell with you? Anything in the Bible remind you of 10 days? You see, this illustrates the difference, and I wouldn't have known this without, you know, doing the study on it. But these people knew their Old Testament. Their Old Testament was their Bible. And when you mention that this is going to go on for 10 days, they thought back and they knew an example of this in the Old Testament. And that is Daniel chapter 1. Daniel and his buddies are gathered up and they're told, you're going to eat the king's food. You know, we're going to get you ready. We're going to get you primed to serve the king. And what does Daniel say? I don't want to eat that stuff, because he wanted to maintain his purity as far as the food laws. And so he makes a deal with them. You know, just they say, no, the stuff you eat, it's not going to do you any good. He says, well, just try it. How many days did they try it for? How many days? 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, what type of shape were they in? They were in great shape. 10 days. So it's almost certainty that these people, when you mention 10 days, would have thought back to this. And they've already been primed in the book of Revelation. Because remember in chapter 1, you have this description of Jesus. The feet like burnished bronze and all the other description there. Go back to Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 10. And those are images that are found in Daniel. So you have a lot of references to Daniel. And you're not even out of the second chapter of the book. So, what is he saying? He's saying in a couple of words, without going into great detail, that you people are going to be just like Daniel. You're going to go through a trial here, but it's going to be a brief trial, and you're going to come out on the other end, and you're going to be victorious. You're going to win. And see, he says all of that just by saying it's just going to last for 10 days. And what that illustrates, I think, is a lot of the commentators say this. This is what gets people in trouble with the book of Revelation. They don't know their Bible. They don't know their Old Testament. And so they go here, there, and everywhere, and they don't have the mentality of having really remembering and understanding and knowing their Bible and knowing all these references. There are scores of references to various Old Testament prophets. We're going to see some more today, and not just in the prophets, but in the Torah, in Numbers, and in Exodus, and everything else. And if you don't know your Old Testament, you're going to miss all this stuff. And by way of illustration, we're going to read this story. Buttercup gave a sigh of relief upon hearing the pronouncement, "He's only half dead." As he lost consciousness, the last words he heard were, "Hello, my name is..." At the same time, he was thinking, "I regret that I only have but one life to..." Now there was at least a glimmer of hope. She decided to save the June date. So much had happened, it was only supposed to be a 3-hour cruise, but she would stand by her man. How many of you catch the references? You got references to movies, you got references to historical events, you got references to songs. He's only half dead. Does that bring up anything for anybody? Got a lot of blank stares. I was hoping my sons would be in here because they would catch this. Who's Buttercup? The Princess Bride. And he's only half dead. Remember the scene in there? They're trying to revive the guy. He's only half dead. If you haven't seen the Princess Bride, you need to watch that movie. That's a great movie. And hello, my name is something Montoya. Yeah, get in here. We got to get these references. Nobody gets this stuff. One of the things they do are movie quotes all the time. He's only half dead, Nathan. Hello, my name is who? See? But for a lot of you, it's just a blank look. That's the way it is in the book of Revelation. If you don't know these things, and it's not only scriptural references in the book of Revelation, we're going to see there are references to historical and stories that are going on at that time. In the book of Revelation, there are these bad guys in the east that are coming. Well, today, who are the bad guys in the east? Red China. And so people want to make it's a prophecy about what's going on in the 21st century. But the Romans had bad guys in the east. On the edge of their frontier were the Parthians. And they were over there always ready, and they did on several occasions invade Rome. So when you talk about this horde, this bad thing that's coming from the east, they weren't thinking about Red China in the first century. They were thinking about the Parthians and this image of being invaded. So if you understand these references, I only have but one life to... All right, what's that from? Nathan Hale. So that's Revolutionary War. She's saving the June date. Come on, ladies. Weddings. June is supposed to be the month for weddings, isn't it? So we got that. 3-hour cruise, we know that one. And Stand By Your Man, we can go a couple different ways with that. We can go to the country song, or we can go with former Secretary of State. But the point is you see, if you're not familiar with these things, they just go over your head. And again, the point is that you have a lot of that in the book of Revelation, and that's these 10 days. So there is no complaint here. There are no negative consequences. Well, it's negative in the sense that they're going to undergo persecution, but Jesus has nothing bad to say about them. They've been very faithful. But he says you need to be faithful even to the point of death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Some translations have this, be faithful even unto death. Now, what's the difference of being faithful to death and being faithful to even to the point of death? Is there any difference? Some of the translations give you the idea you just got to be faithful all your life. That's how a lot of people take it. You're going to get old, you're going to get tired like me, but you got to hang in there and be faithful until you die. That is not what this is referring to. Jesus is saying you're faithful even up to the point where they kill you for your faith, even up to the point of death for your faith. That's the point that he's making. Has nothing to do with hanging in there till you get to be an old person and die as a Christian. It's you're faithful even though they throw you into prison, they torture you, they kill you. And if you do that, you'll receive the crown of life. Now, what is the crown of life? We know what a crown is. It's this fancy thing you put on your head. And the people who are given a crown, a lot of times, what have they done to earn the crown? Well, for a real crown, for a crown in our society, the way we use the term, a lot of times you just inherit the crown, don't you? You've done nothing for it. This is not a crown. This is not a diadem. This is not the word for what a royalty puts on their head when they are crowned king or queen. This is rather the word for a wreath. And there's the god Nike again, and you can see in her left hand outstretched there's a wreath. That's what the word is in the Greek. This was given to athletes, and it was given to victorious generals. And so many times in the New Testament, and especially in the book of Revelation, they may translate it crown, but it's not really a crown. It's a wreath. And so this wreath of life, you're going to be victorious. You're going to, through Christ, you're going to win out over whatever it is that's afflicting you in life. And in the end, you're going to have this spiritual reward of eternal life. And you can see here that bronze figure, and he's got on his head one of these wreaths. So the paradox here is, if you're faithful to the point of death, you're going to receive a victory wreath of life. If you die in the faith, you're going to receive life. You die to receive life. In the Ephesian letter, it was the tree of life that symbolized their reward, their end time reward. Here in the letter to Smyrna, it is the wreath that symbolizes it. So he says, he who overcomes will not be hurt at all by the second death. This word overcomes is that word Nike. It's found in all seven of the letters. If you're a Nike Christian, if you're victorious, if you overcome, you're not going to be hurt by the second death. Well, what is the second death? It's the first death, this physical death, and the second death is this spiritual or eternal death. When Martin Luther died, they found in the margin of his Bible, it said they found in the margin of his Bible, along Revelation 22, he had made this little comment. If you're born once, you're going to die twice. If you're born twice, you'll only die once. And that's a pretty good little pithy summary of what is being said here to the church at Smyrna. So what's the contemporary significance? The New Testament is very plain, very clear on this, that the Christian life is a persecuted life. You see this in the book of Revelation. What did Jesus say? Everyone will hate you because of me. Paul talks about it. Everyone who wants to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. Peter talks about it. James talks about it. Hebrews talks about it. So, how do we suffer as a Christian today? Well, in America, you know, we have it very, very good. But sometimes you may get into, it could be physical, psychological, social. Remember those who are in prison, as if you were in prison with them. That's not talking about the people out here who did this or did that. The people you're remembering who are in prison are the Christians who've been in prison for their faith. Those who have been mistreated, remember them as if you yourself were suffering. And some of you maybe are familiar with the Voice of the Martyrs that tracks and gives information about Christians around the world and in various countries, what they are suffering, being persecuted for their faith. So while we don't have that type of physical persecution that Smyrna was getting ready to undergo, and we're going to see that some other people had suffered in the book of Revelation, still there's psychological and social. And then ripped from the headlines, Christians, although they are a vast minority in Afghanistan, what they have been undergoing as the Taliban takes over. But there is what we might call minor league suffering, financial suffering. We've seen examples in this country of people whose businesses have been boycotted because of certain things that they won't agree to. Some of you may in the past not been hired for a job or sometimes even fired for a job because you won't go along with unethical business practices, or you just see it's a situation that's not going to be a good situation. Theft or destruction of personal property, church buildings are vandalized. The Hebrew writer says, you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, Hebrews 10:34. Other types of minor league suffering, be ridiculed by certain people for some of your beliefs, mocked for some of the ethical standards that you have. And then you see this a lot in film, TV. Religion, Christianity is portrayed in a very unflattering way. So there's both major suffering and minor suffering, but the point to the church at Smyrna and to us today is that you can overcome, you will overcome if we remain faithful to Jesus. So that's to the church at Smyrna. Now we go to Pergamum. Anybody have a comment or question? Pergamum is the church of idolatrous compromise. So to the angel of the church in Pergamum write, these are the words to him who has the sharp double-edged sword. There's only one descriptor here. Jesus is the one who has the sharp double-edged sword. Jesus says, I know where you live. See, he says, I know to all of these. Jesus is very familiar. He's walking among the lampstands. Jesus is walking among us in the sense that he knows our situation. He knows what's going on at Graham Street. He knows those who are staying true to Him and those who are waffling. And when we gossip, when we do this, when we do that, Jesus knows. I know where you live. You live where Satan has his throne. Yet, you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was put to death in your city where Satan lives. Twice in a couple of verses, Jesus mentions that you're where Satan has his residency. Antipas is the only person, only Christian martyr mentioned by name outside of the book of Acts. We could call it Jesus, but other than Jesus, he was put to death in their city where Satan lives. Nevertheless, even though you are being faithful, I have a few things against you. You have people who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to entice the Israelites to sin by eating food sacrificed to idols and committing sexual immorality. Likewise, you also have those who hold to the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Repent, therefore. Otherwise, I will soon come to you and fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give some of the hidden manna. I will also give him a white stone with a new name written on it, known only to him who receives it. So, this is the theater at Pergamum, about the steepest theater in the Roman world. And you can see from this one, off in the distance is the valley. That's 1,300 feet below. We'll talk some more about the city and try to figure out what Satan's throne is. But all Jesus says here is, I'm the one who has the sharp, double-edged sword. This is not the little dagger. This is that 5 to 7 foot long sword that we talked about. The one that you could cut a shield in two with. It's a very powerful sword. The Roman emperor would carry a little dagger as a symbol of his power to judge. Pergamum was the provincial capital. It was the capital of the province of Asia, which meant that's where the governor was, and the governor had the power to execute. So the governor had the power of the sword as well as the emperor. Now notice, therefore, what the contrast here is. You live in a city where the Roman governor has the power to execute. But if you want to talk about the one who really has the power of the sword, Jesus says, I am the one who has that power. So it emphasizes Jesus' role as a judge who has the power to punish the wicked and as the one who really is the one who has the power. And we talked about the two types of swords before. This guy here has got one of these long ramphias, or however you pronounce it. It was so big you had to use two hands. So, the church is warned by this sobering image of Christ as judge. What we've seen so far in the book of Revelation is you don't have the nursery class image of Jesus in the book of Revelation. It is a very powerful, you might even say very scary image. It's an image of judging. It's an image of penetrating and knowing. It's an image of not tolerating evil. So the church there needs to take very seriously any problems they have. And they have this sin of idolatrous compromise that he's going to get to. I know where you live. Satan has his throne there. Yet you've remained true to my name, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness. The word for witness is the same Greek word for martyr. So you can interpose, you can transpose them. So he was a witness. His witness was martyrdom. He was killed for the faith. He's put to death in your city where Satan lives. So they've been faithful, but what does it mean by the throne of Satan? There's a bunch of different ideas today, but it's worth a little bit to talk about it because it'll kind of put you back in the midst of the pressure cooker that these people are living in. This is the Acropolis at Pergamum. It's 1,300 feet above the valley floor. Every city had an Acropolis. That's the high point in the city. Sometimes that is an artificial mound they have to make, but usually it's a hill. And the temple would be on the Acropolis up on top. Sometimes some of the government buildings. In this case, the palace was up there as well. But what you can see here is that you can see the remains of some buildings way up on top. There was a mid-level to the city. And then there's a lower level down here on the valley floor. So there are actually three levels. A lot of the pagan temples are built up here, way on the hill. And so they would be covered with white marble, so they would gleam in the sun. And everybody, wherever you were, down anywhere on the hillside or down in the valley floor, you're going to see these pagan temples. This is up on the upper level, and you can see something built up here. You can see how far you would see it. So what's the throne of Satan? Some people have said, not too convincingly, that it's just the shape of that hill. So that's one idea. Most people think, nah, that's not it. Some think it may refer to the Asclepius Healing Center. Down on the valley floor, there was a very well-known center for healing. And Asclepius was the god of healing. Notice he's got that staff, and he's got a snake curled around it. On your right is the logo for the American Medical Association. In 2021, notice what they have to the left, to the right of it. It's a staff with a single snake. Down through the years, that has remained the symbol of healing. Now, why snakes? Well, in the temple, you would spend the night, and they had non-venomous snakes that would be in there with you, and somehow they were supposed to help in the healing process. So you're in there sleeping, and these snakes are crawling around with you. So that's a good image to go away from class today with. So some people think that was the throne of Satan, because in the healing process is this pagan worship as well. This is a model of up on top of the Acropolis. That right there, we're going to look and see. That's the altar of Zeus. This is that steep theater. And over to the side of it, that was a temple to Dionysus. So if you go to the theater, you're looking at a temple to a pagan god, and probably had some activities associated with that. Up here, they built a platform. That's another pagan temple right here. And there were some other ones as well. So the point is, these buildings were just, if you were up on the Acropolis, you're in the middle of them. If you're down below, when you look up, you see them. So you're just immersed in a world that is a very religious world, but it's a pagan religious world. And you're right in the middle of it. This is where the altar of Zeus was. The Germans came along in the 19th century, and they were helping build a railroad. And the German engineer saw all this stuff that they had built into a wall and noticed these spectacular carvings. And so he gets together and gets with the Ottoman Empire is the one ruling this, and he gets permission, and they cart it all off to Germany, to Berlin, and they reconstruct it. That's the altar, the Zeus. And that hit, it's 40 feet tall. and it's actually been compressed some. The flat area on top was actually much wider than that going back depth-wise, but you only have so big a building to put it in. So that's an altar to Zeus that was up there. It said they burnt sacrifices to Zeus 24/7. And that is that right there. So some people think it's this great Zeus altar that the throne of Satan is being referred to, because you can kind of see you got three sides there, kind of like a throne. Well, maybe, maybe not. But the important point is that is the environment in which these Christians are living in. Some people think it was the imperial cult. Pergamon was the first city to go ahead and get an imperial temple. Pergamum, Ephesus, and Smyrna all competed with one another. They were always competing. They were always competing for the attention and the affection of Rome. And so, to be given by the emperor the blessing to build this imperial temple was a big honor. The title was Neochorus, which means temple keeper. And again, I don't know anything to compare it to today. The honor that it was to be this. And Pergamon was the first one to get that in 29 BC to Caesar Augustus. Well, they get it. Ephesus wants to get it. They get one. Smyrna gets one. Pergamon gets a second one. And so in their writings, they would say, we are the first city with an Acropolis. And then other people have one. And so other people get two. So later on, Pergamon's going to write, we are the first one to have two. So you see, they were always trying to outdo one another. And again, this is the pressure cooker in which these Christians are living, because it was very, very, very important to them to honor the imperial cult, to honor the emperor. And if you're living in the city and you're not participating in this, you're not a good American. You're anti-American. You're anti-Roman. And you are suspect. And you may get turned in to the authorities, and they will test whether or not you are loyal to the empire. Because the one thing that Rome could not stand was if people were not loyal. And then finally, another option is just Pergamum, just in general. It's going to be a center of a Christian persecution, and so we know this about this Antipas, so maybe the throne of Satan is just a city in general. So they're holding fast. We're going to have to quit this morning. But he has a complaint against him. Even though they have held fast, he has a few things against him. They're holding fast to the teaching of Balaam. And you read about this. See, this is one of those, if you don't know your Old Testament, and we've heard the story about Balaam before, because what was the deal about Balaam? What's the funny thing about it? Eeyaw. The donkey. Donkey talks to him. But that's not the point he's making here. Read Numbers 22 through 25 for next week. And then skip over to chapter 31, verses 15 and 16, because that's the punchline for this example. The Nicolaitans, we're just going to throw them in and try to figure them out. But we'll finish this up, and we'll go to Thyatira next week. Thanks for your attention.